sensing. And what are you sensing, Miss Belvoir? Julie sipped her whiskey and locked eyes with Rose. You came so close to a full awakening, Julie said. The others I have met have a long way to go before they embrace the truth, if they ever do. Their past selves are there, but buried, buried deep. They are tiny little whispers in the back of the head. Easy to ignore, easy to drown out, these tiny little whispers. But you, my dear Sergeant, your true self is screaming. You are so close to becoming who you really are. That is why the dreams are so vivid. You are that close. Julie slumped in her seat. Her smile went crooked. Tell me then, do I still sound crazy? What do you think? Rose said, and Julie laughed. I think we are only given a little spark of madness, and we mustn't lose it. Your story has holes big enough to drive a truck through. How would someone from the 17th century know how to, I don't know, drive a car or use a computer? Awakening did not erase the old me. It just... She paused a moment to consider how to phrase it. It put Willa in the back seat so I could drive. I could, if called upon to do so, tell you who Willa's favorite elementary school teacher was. I could describe in detail her first sexual encounter with a boy. I could tell you all about her mother's funeral. All Willa's memories are still here. She tapped a finger to her temple. But they are no longer here, she said, laying her hand over her heart. That sounds awful, Rose said, losing yourself like that. Willa might have thought so. I do not. She threw back the last little swallow of whiskey. I have said my piece, Sergeant. Either you believe me or you do not. I can do no more. Rose stood. You can stay away from me, is what you can do. If that is what you wish. Julie slid out from her seat, straightened up, and promptly pitched into Rose's arms. Whoops, she said, giggling. Gravity. There you are. A young man, tall and handsome and dressed for a night out, plucked Julie out of Rose's grasp. I was worried you left, he said, draping an arm around Julie's neck.
Hello again, Julie chirped. Rose, this is Donnie.
Danny, he corrected. He is pre-med. Pre-law.
Danny Pre-Law was kind enough to buy me drinks earlier.
Julie grabbed Danny's belt buckle for support.
Were you not, darling?
How thoughtful of him, Rose said. I've got her, Danny said, as if only now noticing Rose. I'll make sure she gets back to her place.
Ooh, back to my place, Julie said to Rose in a conspiratorial whisper. I wonder what will happen when we get there.
Oh, I know what'll happen, Rose said. I'll take it from here, Danny. Thanks. It's okay, I've got her, Danny said. Unless maybe you want to join us? Yeah, no, that's not happening. Come on, Julie, let's go. Danny's arm tightened one notch closer to a headlock. I said I got her. Rose flashed her badge. And I said I've got her. Right. That's not even a real badge. Sergeant Booker, Worcester PD, and if you don't back off, you'll find out how real it is. Danny stepped away, his hands up. Rose slung Julie's arm over her shoulders. Word of advice, kid. You want to pick up a girl for a one-nighter? Fine, that's your business. But stick to the sober ones. Intoxicated people can't give informed consent. But you know that, don't you, Danny Pre-Law? Julie staggered alongside Rose as she crossed the main floor, maneuvering through the ever-shifting sea of patrons. They stepped outside. The cool night had turned winter cold.
My hero, Julie said, planting a kiss on Rose's cheek.
Uh-huh. Where are you staying?
Cheap hotel, that way.
She pointed with her cane up the street, and, after a moment of thought, pointed in the other direction.
That way. Pine something.
I know it. Come on. Julie looped her arm through Rose's. For balance, she claimed.
College bars are the best places to find company for the evening, Julie said, answering a question Rose hadn't asked. The men are out to prove themselves in bed, and the women are open to experimentation. Either way, a good time will be had by all.
Hook up a lot, do you?
You do not approve?
Didn't say that.
You do not approve.
It's your life.
Damn right it is, Julie said, her mood swerving suddenly but briefly.
You should try living sometime. You might like it.
My life is just fine, thank you.
Good to hear, good to hear.
The Pine House Inn earned hotel status on a technicality. The proprietor accepted money for temporary lodging, sometimes as temporary as an hour or two. The hotel took up the bulk of the historic ball building. A pawn shop that also cashed checks and offered payday loans occupied the first floor. Police knew it well for its creative record-keeping and few-questions-asked policies. The faux neon sign in the window proclaimed it was open for business. A sign reading, "Hotel, use next door," written in magic marker on the back of a pizza box top, was duct-taped to the pawn shop entrance. An arrow pointed to the next door in question.
"Home sweet home," Rose said. Julie seized Rose's right hand as it reached for the door handle. She held it up and leaned in, her nose almost touching Rose's knuckles, and grunted thoughtfully at the silver Kladov ring encircling the third finger.
"What?" Rose said.
"Nothing."
"What?"
"Nothing. Come, my hero," Julie said, pointing dramatically. "My boudoir awaits."
"Your boudoir," Rose muttered. She followed Julie up a claustrophobia-inducing stairway. The room at the top of the stairs had been converted to an office, its door cut in half and fixed with a length of plywood to present the illusion of a front desk. It was currently unstaffed, but Rose could hear a TV somewhere in the back.
"Next floor up," Julie said.
Her room was near the back of the building. Rose leaned Julie against the wall, found the room key in her coat pocket, and opened the door. Julie smiled a smile rich with intent.
"Do you want to come in?"
"What?
No." "If it is because I cannot..." "How did you put it? If it is because I cannot give informed consent..."
"I have a boyfriend."
"No, you do not."
"Yes, I do."
"You are wearing a Kladov ring."
"Yeah, my boyfriend gave it to me."
"The ring is on your right hand, and the point of the heart is oriented away from your wrist. That means you are single and looking."
Rose checked. The ring depicted two hands holding a heart, topped by a crown. The bottom of the heart pointed toward her fingertip.
"I'm not single," she said, "and I'm not looking."
"Then you should turn the ring around. That signifies that you are in a relationship."
"And you should have a big drink of water before you go to bed if you want to avoid a hangover."
"I shall do that," Julie laughed her musical laugh.
"My hero, saving me from myself." Rose started down the hall. She paused at the top of the stairs.
Her story is utterly crazy.
She's crazy.
Or drunk.
Or both.
"Who am I?"
Rose demanded. Julie squinted, uncomprehending.
"If I'm like you, and I'm really an old soul in a new body, then who am I?"
"I do not know," Julie admitted. "Mother would know. She could tell you."
"Your mother could..."
"Not my mother. Mother."
She waved her hand as if shooing away a mosquito buzzing about her head.
"We can discuss it at another time. Good night, my dear sergeant."
Julie shut the door. Rose stood there, glowering at the spot where Julie had been, telling herself that Julie d'Aubigny was a crazy woman who didn't deserve one more second of her time. Julie's closed door stole away 10 minutes of Rose's life.
Five.
For a moment, she felt as if she were flying.
Rose flailed awake, her face soaked with tears, a scream trapped in her throat. Calvin slept through the thrashing, but there was no sleeping through Rose's anguished wail when it finally broke free. She fell out of bed, each inhalation a pain-racked wheeze, each exhalation a terrified sob.
"Jesus, Rose!"
She stood and tried to run. She fell again, pushed back up to her feet, and managed to reach the bathroom before her stomach emptied. Her bladder followed. Calvin flipped on the bathroom light and recoiled from the mess on the floor. He stepped over the spreading puddle, grimacing, and knelt down. Rose sank her fingernails into his flesh and crawled into his arms. His heart thundered, his stomach lurched, but he held Rose and told her in a steady, gentle voice that he wasn't letting her go. He was right there. Everything would be all right. Her sobs subsided with each shuddering breath.
"I had the dream again," Rose said, her voice brittle and quavering.
She buried her face in Calvin's chest.
"I'm sorry."
"No, shh, don't. It's okay."
Calvin cradled her in one arm while he turned on the shower. Once the water warmed up, he helped Rose into the tub. She sat there, trembling violently, unable to find comfort in the soothing rain. A knot of pain throbbed dully behind her left ear.
"I'm sorry," she said again.
"It's okay. You stay here."
Calvin left and returned with a roll of paper towels. After he finished cleaning the floor, he wiped himself down, his lips puckered in disgust. And then he knelt down next to the tub.
"You should call in."
"I've only been back one day."
"Rose, come on."
"I had a bad dream, is all."
"This was way more than a bad dream," he hesitated. "The doctor warned you this could happen."
"This wasn't PTSD.
"Then what the hell was it?"
"I don't know. Don't yell at me."
"I'm not... I'm sorry. I didn't mean to snap at you. I'm just a little freaked out, is all."
Rose hugged her knees to her chest.
"Rose, please, please stay home today."
"I have to go to work."
"No, you don't. You can't, not like this."
Her face hardened.
"Don't tell me what I can't do."
"Rose."
"Don't tell me what I can't do."
"Damn it, Rose, you're a mess. You're in no shape to go out there and... Christ, will you please just do what I say?"
"Do what you say?"
She was on her feet in an instant, fists clenched, eyes blazing.
"What do you think I am, eh? Some common whore you can order about?"
Calvin's mouth fell open.
"Jesus, Rose."
"What? What?"
She stepped out of the tub. Calvin backed away and nearly slipped on the wet tile.
"Out of my way," she snarled.
"Rose, stop, please."
She pulled a pair of jeans out of a dresser drawer and wrestled them on over her wet legs.
"Where are you going?"
"Out."
"Where?"
"Out."
"Rose."
"What, do I need your permission to go out too?"
"It's 3 in the morning. For Christ's sake, please."
She froze, a tank top in her trembling hands. 9 months ago, she stormed out on Calvin following an argument that climaxed with those same words, that same desperate plea. "For Christ's sake, please." That was the last thing Calvin said to her on that terrible day. Almost the last words she ever heard him say. And she promised herself she'd never again leave the apartment angry at him. She promised.
"I need to blow off some steam, okay? I'm not going to get back to sleep, so I'm going to go to work. Hit the gym." "I don't want you to go to work," Calvin said.
"I know you don't," Rose said. "But you need to let me go."
She left before Calvin could muster another protest. Her form was terrible. She wasn't delivering kicks the way she was taught to maximize her speed and power. Mules kicked with greater finesse. The heavy bag jumped from the impact anyway and swung lazily on its chain.
Rose greeted its return with a low punch that sent an electric shock through her wrist and up her arm. She ignored it, and machine-gunned fists into the bag, a breathless curse accompanying each blow. Fucking nightmares. Fucking Julie or Willa or whatever the hell her name was, and her crazy fucking stories. Fucking Alex Cornelius. Fucking... Rose grunted, a name on the tip of her tongue. A name attached to a pathetic, contemptible man with a regrettable profile. A beak of a nose, red and angry, took up too much space on a face capped by a weak little nub of a chin. His lips bent in a perpetual snivel, and hair turning prematurely gray hung in greasy strands. Everything about him was too pathetic to properly hate. Rose's punch landed with a dull thud. "Fuck you too," she said, "whoever you are."
"What are you doing here so early?"
Owen said. She tossed her towel onto the closest bench and finished wrapping her hands in a pair of leather workout gloves. "Nothing," Rose said, wiping away tears. Maybe Owens would think it was sweat.
"Is everything okay?"
"Yes."
"Come on, talk to me."
"Is that an order?"
"It's a friendly suggestion."
"Cal and I had a fight."
"Oh, Rose."
Owens leaned against the heavy bag.
"Was it about you coming back to work?"
"Sort of."
"I thought you said Calvin had moved past that."
"He said he had."
"But he hasn't."
"No."
"I assume you've tried to talk to him about it?"
"Of course I have. I've tried to get him to open up. So many times, but when he really doesn't want to talk about something."
"I wish I knew what to tell you, I really do. I hope you know I'm totally on your side. I give you all the credit in the world for having the guts to come back after...
you know." "You can say it." She didn't.
"But in fairness, I understand where he's coming from. He almost lost you, and he's probably scared shitless it'll happen again. You can't just tell the guy to get over it and expect it to stick. Man's got a right to his feelings."
"I know, I know. Wish I knew what to tell you." "Me too." Rose thumped the heavy bag. "All yours." The free weights weren't as satisfying as the bag, but they helped kill another 20 minutes. Several reps of vigorous crunches ate up 15 more. A hot shower took care of the rest of the wee hours. By the end of it, the hot pit of anger sitting in her belly had cooled to embers. But still, it burned. Rose checked her phone. Almost 4. Calvin would be home in an hour or so. She had no reason to linger at the station. The day had been blessedly, painfully slow. A couple of traffic tickets, a few verbal warnings, one stern admonition delivered to 2 guys who got into an excessively loud, profane political debate at a Dunkin' Donuts and refused to leave when told to by the shift manager. Another thrill-a-minute ride on the Worcester PD roller coaster, as Aldwin liked to say. All her reports were written and checked for accuracy and filed, and there was no busy work to be found. She had no reason to linger. Rose stared at the monitor, her fingers hovering over the keyboard. There was no point in looking her up. She was a crazy woman, mostly harmless. She typed in the name, Willa Belvoir. The report she filed the day of the bar fight came up, as did Aldwin's report, for starters. Willa Belvoir's arrest record was substantial. Rose called a phone number she found in one of the attached reports. Area code 206. Seattle. "Hello, is this John Belvoir? This is Sergeant Rose Booker of the Worcester Police Department out in Massachusetts. I'm sorry to bother you, but I need to ask you a few questions about your wife."
6.
Erkan Valdemar opened his eyes. He immediately closed them again, then reopened them at a squint. The morning sun streamed into his room, warm and welcoming and exceptionally brilliant. He picked up the call button resting on the bed near his hand, the hand with the gauze pad taped over where the IV had been, then changed his mind and set it back down. He fought with the guardrail a bit before he got it to fold down, and then swung his feet down to the floor. The cool tile was refreshing, better than a hot cup of tea. He rolled down the Venetian blinds. The room dimmed. He nodded approvingly and returned to bed. Erkan turned the TV on for the sake of dispelling the near silence. The morning shift was starting up, and the hallway beyond his door bustled and buzzed with soft conversation and softer footsteps, the cat-like tread of nurses in rubber-soled flats. White noise to lull a man to sleep. No more of that. He'd slept his fair share, and then some. He scratched at an imaginary itch, a phantom tickle running along the left side of his scalp, beneath a streak of hair that had grown back colorlessly. Isabel teased that he looked rather like a skunk now. A distinguished skunk, but a skunk nonetheless. Erkan Lepew. He smiled. Leave it to Isabel to find the humor in that.
Good morning, Mr. Valdemar.
The man Erkan had come to call Nurse Lauren entered with his bright, toothy smile firmly in place.
How are we feeling today?
We are...
Erkan stopped, took a breath, and sounded it out in his head first.
We are feeling very well, Nurse Lauren. Thank you.
I bet you're excited to be going home today.
You have no idea.
Nurse Lauren gave him a smile tinged with pity. Erkan told himself it was sympathy. Sympathy he could accept gracefully.
I know it's tough, Mr. Valdemar, but you'll get there. You've made it this far.
Erkan nodded.
I appreciate all you've done for me, Lauren. I won't forget the kindness and respect you've shown me.
Thank you, Mr. Valdemar. And you're welcome.
He added with a wink.
I hope I never see you in this hospital again.
Except when they name a new wing after me, of course.
Nurse Lauren laughed and returned to his rounds. It wasn't a joke. After all St. Vincent's had done for him, Erkan thought, the place would never want again. Renovations? Done. New equipment? Done. If Nurse Lauren had any debt, he'd soon find it mysteriously wiped out. That was how it worked. What you receive is what you repay. Erkan laid back and stared at the television without really paying any attention to it. The morning news was an insult, shallow entertainment masquerading as enlightenment, tailored for the masses and presented with a heavy coating of sugar to make the bad news go down more easily. Toss in an amateur video of a raccoon with its head stuck in a peanut butter jar, or a bear frolicking in someone's backyard pool, and suddenly, no one notices how badly the world is falling apart. Pathetic. The door swung open silently. The space filled with a buzz-cut-wearing monolith of a man in a subdued gray suit. Hammond peeked about the room and, satisfied, stepped aside to hold the door open for Erkan's visitors.
"Good morning," Erkan said, smiling.
Isabel was wearing one of his favorite outfits, a deep red suit jacket and a matching skirt that molded to her hourglass figure.
"Good morning," Isabel said.
"Mr. Valdemar,"
said the slight African-American man shadowing Isabel.
"Mr. Manish," Erkan said with a nod.
Hammond closed the door and placed himself in front of it, a human barricade. Isabel draped a garment bag over the back of the chair in which she normally sat during their visits.
"How are we feeling today?"
"You sound like Nurse Lauren," Erkan chuckled.
"And what did you tell him?"
"That I am feeling very well."
"And you are ready to go home?"
"More than ready."
"Good to hear that, Mr. Valdemar," Manish said, in that tone. "There's no need to go right back to work. We've been holding things together admirably during your, convalescence. We can spare another few days for you to reacclimate."
"Holding together?" Isabel said. "Is that how you see it, Mr. Manish?"
"I stand by my assessment," Manish said with professional detachment. "I won't deny that other parties have taken advantage of the fact Mr. Valdemar has not had a direct hand in day-to-day operations."
I'm right here, Mr. Manish, Erkan said. Sorry, sir. All I'm saying is, in light of the circumstances, we should take the win. We anticipated some, slippage, and we've dealt with it as best we could. Things could be much worse.
They could be much better, Isabel said.
All right, all right. Let's not have any of that, Erkan said. Squabbling amongst ourselves won't accomplish anything, will it? I appreciate your concerns, Isabel, but I'm not going back to work quite yet. Mr. Manish can steer the ship for a day or two longer, while I take care of some other business first. Manish offered a small bow.
Of course he can, Isabel said.
She brought the garment bag over to her husband.
Let's get you out of here.
Hospital rules, Nurse Lauren explained apologetically. Erkan didn't like it, but he appreciated Nurse Lauren's discipline. There were protocols, and Nurse Lauren respected them. If he said the rules demanded that patients must be taken out in a wheelchair, so be it. Erkan held his head high, all the way to the hospital entrance. There was no indignity here. Nurse Lauren rolled Erkan up to the black stretch Cadillac idling by the curb. Sharon stepped out from behind the wheel and circled around to open the back door for her employer. Erkan stood and smoothed out his charcoal suit, one of his favorites, and proffered a hand to his favorite caretaker.
I meant what I said, Lauren. I won't forget your kindness.
Keep him out of trouble, Nurse Lauren said to Isabel.
Isabel grinned.
Never.
Chandler Hill wasn't the best neighborhood. Erkan couldn't honestly say it was worst, but it was never the best. It was always raw and rough and run down, always being the length and breadth of his memory. The residents who dared to own a car avoided buying anything nice. Nice cars got stolen. No one put much effort into keeping up their homes. Nice homes got broken into. Children, regardless of how polite and well-behaved they were at home, acted like hellions once they stepped out into the world. Nice kids got beaten up. Growing up, Erkan vowed to never let anyone mistake him for a nice kid. Grown up, Erkan vowed that Chandler Hill residents would be allowed to have nice cars and nice homes and nice kids. Chandler Hill, for a start. It wasn't the best neighborhood, but it was better by far than what he had when he lived here. That didn't stop him from trying to get Mama out, though. She, of course, refused. This was her native soil. Her roots were too deep. Erkan often suspected she resented him for daring to find greener fields, but if she did, she kept it to herself. Sharon pulled up to the curb with the deft, fine touch of a seasoned sea captain sliding his ship into its berth. She lowered the smoked glass panel separating her from her passengers.
"We're here, sir," she said as a matter of duty.
Erkan knew exactly where he was. The house, though well kept and clean, was still ugly as sin. A plain box of a thing wrapped in vinyl siding, the same pale industrial green one might find in an old medical facility. Small windows dotted each face like pips on a die. Strips of lawn barely wide enough to accommodate a mower surrounded the structure, and a rust-freckled chain-link fence surrounded that. Isabel took Erkan's hand.
"Would you like me to come in with you?"
"No."
He tore his eyes away from the box.
"But if you don't want to wait..."
"You always keep me waiting," she smiled. "I'm used to it."
Hammond stepped out of the car first. He looked up and down the street, his hand up near the knot of his plain black necktie, as if straightening it. He gestured to his employer and shadowed him as he walked up to the house. Erkan paused when something crunched beneath his feet. Tiny, angular chunks of broken glass, glittering pale green in the sun like gemstones. He didn't need to ring the doorbell and wait to be buzzed in. He had his key. The temperature rose with each flight of stairs. The small third-floor landing was a sauna. Erkan knocked on the door to apartment 3A and presented himself for the peephole.
A safety chain and a deadbolt disengaged, and the door crept open. Ege Valdemar's dark round eyes widened, coming alive and lighting up her dark round face. She took her son in her arms and held him as tightly as her frail limbs would allow, and she cried into his chest. Her tears would ruin his ivory silk tie. Erkan kissed his mother on the top of her head. It was only a tie. He nodded to Hammond, a silent order to stand guard in the hallway, then stepped inside.
"Mama," he said,
triggering a second gush of tears. But these were not tears of joy.
"I'm so sorry," she whispered. "I should have... I couldn't. I couldn't."
"I know, Mama. It's all right. I know how you feel about hospitals. It's all right."
She flapped her hands as if fanning herself, dabbed her eyes on her sleeves, and then, predictably, bustled into the kitchen. The golden rule of the Valdemar household held as true as ever. When in doubt, tea.
"I have some fresh lapsang souchong,"
Ege said as she filled a kettle, dented from repeated dropping and blackened from years of use.
"Sounds wonderful, Mama. Thank you."
Ege beamed. The tears continued to fall.
"I should ask how you're doing," she said.
"I'm happy to be out of bed."
Ege's laugh was low and throaty.
"I remember when you used to brag that you'd be so rich one day, you'd be able to stay in bed all day if you wanted."
"I was not careful about what I wished for." He grimaced. "I was not careful about what I wished for."
Ege, squinting, waved her hand at him. She could say a million things with that one gesture.
"The doctor said it's not unusual to develop speech issues after a serious head injury," Erkan explained.
"They never caught who did this to you," she said, jabbing a finger at no one in particular. "The police."
"No, Mama," Erkan said, and that was the truth. The police never caught the triggerman.
They never found his body, either.
"This city," Ege lamented.
She brought the kettle over to a gas stove so old, replacement parts were no longer available. The flame came on with an airy pop.
"Always 2 steps forward, 1 step back. Jorge, the nice man downstairs on the first floor? Someone stole his car last night, right out of the driveway."
"I saw the broken glass."
"This city."
"I know. I worry about you."
Ege dismissed him with a flick of the wrist and began setting the table for a proper tea for two. Saucers, cups, the good sugar bowl. She dropped the matching creamer long ago and to this day cursed its absence. And a box of the blandly sweet tea biscuits she loved. The ones that always seemed to be stale, even when the package was fresh from the supermarket.
"Isabel is waiting down in the car, isn't she?"
Ege said.
"She didn't want to intrude."
"Oh no, mustn't intrude."
Erkan furrowed his brow.
"Is everything all right between you two?"
"Ask her."
"I'm asking you."
"Ask her. After you."
A sigh slid through her clenched teeth as a hiss.
"She's been called ever since. Barely visited. Called 2 times a week, if that, to let me know how you were doing. And no more. I visited her once. She didn't want me there. She was civil, but she didn't want me there."
"Did you have a fight?"
"If we did, I don't know about it."
"This has been hard on her, Mama. On top of everything, she was left running the business while I..."
"Don't make excuses for her,"
Ege said with an emphatic wag of her finger.
"She's a strong woman. That's why I let you marry her."
"Let me?" Erkan laughed.
"She didn't turn cold because she was..."
She idly twirled a hand as she sought the proper phrasing.
"Overwhelmed," Erkan offered.
Ege grunted in the affirmative.
"Come now, Mama. This wasn't..."
"I said no excuses. I felt everything she felt."
Her eyes glimmered with an impending wave of fresh tears. She thumped a fist against her heart.
Everything. It didn't make me hard. It didn't make me cold.
Erkan went to his mother and held her.
No, Mama, it didn't. I'll talk to her.
The kettle let loose a banshee shriek.
Sit,
Ece said.
Tea's ready.
Erkan pulled out a chair. He paused.
Mama, he said. Your neighbor, the one whose car was stolen. Do you know what kind of car it was?
Isabel called their home the Overlook. It came to her the day they first toured the house, a grand old colonial on 5 acres, and saw that the upstairs hallway carpeting was identical to that of the hotel featured in The Shining. Same colors, same hypnotic pattern. She didn't care for the movie, a little too violent for her tastes, but she found the coincidence amusing. The house itself did not share the fictional mountain lodge's grandeur, or its sordid history. But it had the carpets, and Erkan made sure they were always scrupulously maintained. Sharon pulled the car up to the front gate, a barrier of high wrought iron bars, each tip a fleur-de-lis with a sharpened point. The gate opened with the push of a button on the steering wheel and closed behind them with a second push. Sharon drove up to the front door and eased to a stop. Hammond got out and scanned the grounds before opening the car door.
"Welcome back, sir," he said.
Erkan pinched his eyes closed upon entering his home for the first time in months. The foyer, a grand high-ceilinged room floored with mirror-polished white marble tile, gleamed like the heavens, illuminated from the late morning sun streaming in through windows better suited for a Catholic church. Isabel took Erkan by the elbow, a question in her eyes.
"Bright," he said.
"It never bothered you before,"
Isabel said. She looked around and made a thoughtful noise.
"It is, though, isn't it? Might be time to redecorate. Something a little more subdued, perhaps."
"I wouldn't object."
Isabel slipped her arm around her husband's waist.
"Tell me, what would you like to do with the rest of your day?"
"I would like to eat a dinner that hasn't been robbed of all flavor. I want to wash it down with the best wine we have. I want a rich, decadent dessert that isn't jello. I want to sleep in my own bed, next to you. Right now, I dearly want a real shower."
They passed Paige in the upstairs hallway as she dutifully vacuumed the Overlook carpets. She gasped in delight, and the vacuum fell from her hand. Erkan normally didn't allow the staff to hug him. He made an exception this once. He stripped out of his clothes as soon as Isabel closed the bedroom door. His suit suddenly felt too tight on him, too hot. Erkan was naked to the waist by the time he reached the bathroom door. He left his pants on the floor near the toilet and stepped into the shower. The cold water hurt, but pleasantly so. A frisson ran down his spine, and he let out a shuddering sigh. He inched the temperature up, but not by much. He closed his eyes and leaned against the shower wall to let the water run down his back. He heard the mottled glass door slide open, then closed. Isabel lathered up her hands and ran them over his shoulders, down his back, around to his belly. His muscles had lost their distinct sculpted contours from so many weeks of being bedridden, but they were still firm beneath her fingers. Two bumps, one high on his abdomen, one low, marred the smooth, taut skin. Two more, bisected by a line of scar tissue, formed a semicolon on his sternum, to the right of his heart. Erkan turned, fiercely erect. Isabel drew him into her arms. He bowed his head to kiss the curve where her neck and shoulders met, then gave her a gentle nibble.
"Harder,"
Isabel said. She dragged her fingernails down his back.
"Harder."
He bit down. She gasped. She moaned. Their lovemaking was normally slow, deliberate, tender. Erkan sat up, leaving behind on the royal purple bedsheets an imprint of the fingernail marks hashtagging his back.
his cock hurt.
"Let's stay here for the rest of the day," Isabel said, her throat raw.
The staff was paid well enough. They'd pretend they never heard a thing.
"I've had enough of beds for a while.
Should I prop you up in a corner for the night, then?"
Erkan chuckled. He glanced back at Isabel. Tears stained her cheeks, but she was smiling. An ugly blackish-purple semicircle glowed neon against the pale skin at the base of her throat.
"I need to get back to work," he said.
"You said Manish could handle things for a few more days."
"He can. I can't."
Isabel sat up and kissed his shoulder.
"Good.
Good.
I did my best to keep Manish on task, and he did his best to keep the business on task. But I am not you. Manish certainly is not you."
She kissed his shoulder again, her tongue tracing the row of thin, jagged red lines her nails had left behind.
"You need to show everyone your back. Really show them."
"Instill them with the fear of God, eh?"
"No, not God."
Erkan met her eyes. They were dark, angry.
"The fear of you."
7. It always took time for Calvin to recover from a fight, no matter how big or how small. He had his own schedule. Rose tried to respect that. She didn't like it, but she tried to respect it. Tuesday night was mired in terse silence, without so much as a "how was your day" passing between them. She ate dinner at the small dining table in the kitchen. He took his in the living room, with the evening news anchors as his company. She went to bed soon afterwards. Calvin wasn't there when her nightly terror caused her to flail out of bed. She stood rubbing the elbow she'd cracked on the corner of the nightstand on her way down, and saw a blank space where his pillow should have been. She found him asleep on the couch. 3 empty beer bottles stood at attention on the coffee table. On her way out the door to go to work, she said goodbye. He said nothing in return. She told herself Calvin was asleep. They achieved an illusory normalcy by Wednesday evening. They made light chit-chat as they ate together at the kitchen table, but it was mechanical, perfunctory. They behaved as 2 people in a years-long relationship were supposed to, and no more. After dinner, they sat on the couch with the width of a person between them and stared at the TV. Rose went to bed alone again. Thursday was a little better. The small talk was less forced. The gap on the couch shrank. And by the end of the night, their hands were intertwined.
"You're off tomorrow," Calvin said.
"And Saturday," Rose replied. "Back in on Sunday."
She waited for him to say more. "Had a meeting with the chief today," she said.
"About what?"
"How I was doing."
"Ah."
She waited.
"He was happy with how the first week went," Rose said. "He's probably going to keep me riding with someone for at least 1 more rotation. After that, I should be back to riding solo."
"Good," Calvin said.
The word had no meaning. He never looked at her. Rose took her hand away.
"I'm going to bed."
"Okay."
"I love you."
"Love you too," he said to an empty space in front of Rose.
It was midnight when she finally fell asleep. According to Calvin's post-argument recovery schedule, he'd rejoin her. He'd come to bed, snuggle up next to her, and come the morning, everything would be back to normal. Rose woke up late. She woke up alone. Again. The bed beside her was undisturbed. Calvin himself was long gone. Rose found a half a pot of coffee and a bowl sitting in the sink. Flecks of cornflakes adhered to the side. Rose showered, dressed, tucked her gun in its belt holster, and tucked that in her belt at the base of her spine.
She threw on her favorite bomber jacket, the one she bought for $20 at one of the local third-rate flea markets, where the contents of people's basements and garages commingled with milk crates full of old vinyl, televisions that remembered the days of UHF, boomboxes from the cassette era, and bargain-priced toiletries that fell off the back of a truck. Her hair went under a Red Sox cap to hide the oily sheen it had developed overnight. Before leaving, she checked her phone. There were no missed calls from any unknown numbers, or from the Pine House Inn, with which she'd left several messages, despite her firm belief the desk clerk never wrote them down, much less passed them along. She drove over to the hotel, walked in, walked up, and knocked on Julie's door. That Julie actually answered came as a minor surprise. That she was dressed in a man's shirt that she'd neglected to button up before opening the door? Somehow less so.
"Well, hello,"
Julie said, the crookedness of her smile suggesting she was in that sweet spot between the end of drunkenness and the beginning of a hangover. "We need to talk," Rose said. Julie stood aside and welcomed Rose in with a sweep of her arm. The room was predictably appalling. The walls and ceilings had once been white, or something close to. Their present color, Rose would have described as a dreary sepia, the unmistakable result of various occupants ignoring the no-smoking rule for years on end. The faint plink, plink, plink of a dripping tap drifted out from a bathroom little bigger than a closet. The bed was the standard cheap motel model, a mattress lacking a box spring laid upon a steel frame covered in peeling gray paint. The young African-American woman sprawled atop the bed, bare to the world, didn't seem to mind the substandard accommodations. She stretched out and greeted Rose with a sleepy smile.
"Hi,"
she said.
"Rona, this is my friend Rose,"
Julie said.
"Hi,"
Rona said again.
"Uh-huh,"
Rose said.
"Time to rouse yourself, my darling. Rose and I have some important things to discuss,"
Julie said.
"And you, as I recall, have classes to attend."
"Oh," Rona said, snapping upright. She dressed hastily, slipping into a pair of skinny jeans and a tank top without bothering to first put on her lacy bra and panties. She stuffed her underwear into her purse and jammed her feet into a pair of new and expensive-looking Nikes. She paused at the door.
"Call me?"
"If you are good," Julie said.
She took Rona by the back of the head and drew her in. Julie kissed her, passionately, and she did so while looking directly at Rose. Rona wobbled out of the room.
"Her I might actually call."
"So she can experiment a little more?" Rose said.
"Oh, she knew exactly what she was doing. Now what is it you need to speak to me about?"
"John Belvoir, your husband." Julie's smile remained in place, but the light in her eyes dimmed ever so slightly.
"That's for starters. Then maybe we could discuss your son, John Belvoir, Jr. But before that, let's discuss you, Willa."
Julie sighed. She brushed by Rose and sat on the bed, her legs unselfconsciously apart.
"Been reading up on me, have you?"
"I read up on Julie d'Aubigny, French opera singer from the 17th century, real hellraiser. Fought and fucked her way all up and down France. I read one story that claims she burned down a convent to fake her lover's death."
100% true," Julie said, beaming. "One of my shining moments, I dare say."
"But that's not you. And what I learned about you, Willa Belvoir, I learned by talking to your still very distraught husband. Want to know what he told me?"
Julie shrugged.
"He told me you two had a good life once. Met late in college, got engaged soon after graduation, held off on getting married until he got his career settled, and then? Domestic bliss. Home in the burbs, white picket fence, the whole package. And then you started working on the 2.5 kids." Rose's hand balled into a fist. "He told me you died. You cracked your pelvis while giving birth to your son. It severed an artery. You bled out. The doctors managed to revive you, but you still died. John said you weren't the same afterwards. You became distant,
withdrawn, moody. You wouldn't talk to him. You didn't want to see your own child. You refused to go to couples therapy, and then one day, out of the blue, you disappeared without a word. Your husband filed a missing persons report.
Obviously, I am not missing.
No, but I do think you're lost.
Julie, her smile suddenly hard, stood and crossed her arms.
Do tell.
I get what you went through. You know I'm not just saying that. I get it. Waking up to learn I had been technically dead for 6 minutes? That messed me up. I spent as much time in counseling as I did in recovery, trying to get a handle on it. And there were so many times I wanted to run away from my own life.
I see. Julie nodded to herself. You think my near-death experience made me realize how dreary and dull my picture-perfect suburban life was, so I decided to reinvent myself as a wild child party girl. Something like that?
Exactly like that.
Oh, Rose, my dear sergeant, you could not be more wrong, Julie said with a melancholy note. John was a good man, generally speaking. Not perfect, not at all, but basically a good man. An argument could be made that he deserved better. My son most definitely did.
She sighed and sat down again.
As a rule, I do not deal in regret, but leaving my child, that weighs on me.
Then why did you do it?
Julie closed her eyes briefly. She had the most brilliant eyes Rose could remember seeing. Not colorful, but bright, warm, alive. In this moment, however, they were two cold, hard marbles.
I remember the exact day I woke up next to John and realized I felt nothing for him. Any love for him I once knew?
She snapped her fingers.
Gone. He was not my husband of 14 years. He was just some man in my bed. The tiny little boy in the crib? I felt nothing.
She snapped her fingers again.
Gone. I had no reason to stay there, so I packed my bags, got in the car, and I left.
Without saying a word, didn't even leave a note, Rose said, seething. I read the missing person report. You didn't just abandon him. You scared the living hell out of him.
I was a coward, Julie said, her jaw tight.
Still are. He said he's tried to call you. You won't talk to him. The man needs closure, and you won't give it to him. That's beyond cowardly. That's cruel.
Then it is cruel. It is who I am. And that, Rose Booger, is my point. I am not insane. I am not deluded. I am not some midlife crisis-ridden housefrau seeking escape from a life of humdrum domesticity. This is who I am.
Honestly, I don't give a tin shit who you say you are. You want to tell people you're a reincarnated Frenchwoman? Rose threw her hands up. Great, it's your life. Go nuts. What I do care about is the fact that you're trying to drag me into your stupid little fantasy.
Julie gave her a haughty smile, the kind that invited a stiff slap.
I have dragged you nowhere. You came to me twice.
Why is that, I wonder?
She stepped into a pair of jeans puddled on the floor and pulled them up.
Are you feeling brave today, Sergeant?
Why?
I did not wind up in Worcester by chance. I came here looking for someone, and I found her. She can answer every question you have. You just have to be courageous enough to ask.
She buttoned up her shirt and threw on her coat.
Well, are you feeling brave today?
More insanity. Another hoop to jump through, leading nowhere but to more insanity, more hoops, over and over and over, with no end in sight.
Yes, Rose said. Then let me introduce you to Mother.
When Julie said they were going to a church, Rose assumed she meant a church. A steeple and a bell, big wooden double doors, stained glass windows. A church. The New Life Church qualified for the name only as far as it needed to for tax purposes. Based on the facade, the alleged house of worship had once been a neighborhood corner convenience store. It still had the roll-down security grates. The ones over the windows were down and secured by rusty padlocks. The grate over the entrance was up, but not all the way. The women had to duck slightly to reach the glass front door, which doubled as a bulletin board. Flyers festooned with clip art announced Bible study sessions, youth and adult, choir auditions this weekend, and a social for new members next Friday night. "Why do I feel like this is a setup for some bizarre practical joke?" Rose said.
"Who says it is not?" Julie said.
She held the door open and gestured for Rose to enter. Much of the floor was dedicated to worship services. A battered lectern stood against the far wall past several rows of folding chairs, and, here and there, cheap plastic Adirondack chairs. Any question as to the church's former life was dispelled when Rose turned and beheld the store's original counter, intact but absent its register and displays. The church's collection of mismatching Bibles and hymnals occupied shelves that once held candy and gum. The woman sitting behind the counter sipping from a can of Tab was, like her church, a bit of this and a bit of that. But unlike her church, she defied easy categorization. Her steel-gray hair was buzzed almost to the scalp, and her complexion refused to settle on any distinct ethnicity. Her age could have been anything from a hard 40 to a well-preserved 60, but her drab-gray suit jacket, slightly ill-fitting, nudged Rose's estimate toward the higher end.
"It's not much, but it's home," the woman said.
"Good morning, Mother," Julie said.
"Hello, Julie."
The woman laid down her Bible, scribbled something down in a spiral notebook, frowned at whatever she'd written, and shrugged with her eyebrows. She looked up and folded her hands atop the counter and remarked,
"You look rough."
"Late night."
"They always are with you," Mother said, a gentle criticism. She smiled at Rose. "Hello, Mary."
"My name's not Mary," Rose said.
"What do you call yourself, then?"
"Rose."
"Rose," Mother said, as if trying out the name.
She shrugged with her eyebrows again and stood with a grunt.
"May I approach?"
Rose, uncertainly, nodded. Mother had to tilt her head slightly to look up at Rose. She raised a hand slowly, letting Rose see quite clearly what she was doing, and touched two cool fingertips to Rose's forehead.
"Hmm, you're very close," Mother said with mild interest. "The dreams must be terrible for you."
Rose backed away.
"Look, whoever you are—"
I know, you're sick of everyone acting like they know more about what's going on than you do, and you want to be let in on the secret," Mother said. "Well then, you might want to brace yourself, because I'm about to do something I don't do often. Give you a straight answer. Are you braced, Mary?"
"My name's not—"
"Mary Reed."
Rose flinched as if she'd been punched square in the nose. It hurt to draw a breath, hurt like there was a knife in her sternum, twisting, sawing against the bone. She was distantly aware of Julie's hands on her arms, holding her up.
"I don't know who that is," Rose said, a denial with no conviction behind it.
"It's who you are," Mother said. "Were. Are again. You listen."
Mother, her hands clasped behind her back, paced a slow circle around her visitors.
"Now I'll warn you. I don't know all the answers," she began. "But no one does, and no one ever will. That's how it is. Creation is far too vast for us to ever know entirely. I can only tell you what I know, which is a lot. But it's not everything. Hope that's not a problem."
She gave Rose a moment to respond, one way or the other.